You ready for some coffee, honey?
Absolutely.
I'll pour.
Great coffee. I'm Dr. Ron Martinelli.
And I'm Linda Martinelli.
And we are Talking
While Married. I want to talk with you about President Trump. I want to talk with you a little bit about the reasons why I feel that every American should vote for President Trump again over Joe Biden. And it really goes back to 2016 when President Trump was on the campaign trail and his motto was Make America Great Again. And what his goal was to strengthen America, strengthen our economy, bring jobs back to America, bring money that was overseas back to America, and reduce the regulations that were preventing jobs in America. And he, just being a businessman, Ron, he understands that the power of the economy is just so important to the country, and that if we could get the jobs back, like the manufacturing jobs that we were told in the Obama administration would never happen on American soil again, then we could be much more able to make America great again.
Well, I don't think our country is any different than any other country. The country's success or failure is directly connected to the economy and the vibrance of the economy or the decay in the economy. And so I think we have to remember contextually that we went through three prior administrations, including a prior Republican administration, that we were just not moving forward as a nation the way that we needed to move economically, employment wise, with industry. We were locked in wars in the Middle East. We were fully engaged in that, which is a huge drain on the economy. You know, some parts of the economy, for instance, what they refer to as the military-industrial complex, they will thrive whenever the United States is in conflict, but not the rest of us. And so I think when President Trump was elected on that theme of Make America Great Again, he really has done a remarkable job given all the obstructions that he's had every single day, 24/7, in keeping the vast majority of all of his promises, which in my lifetime is unique with the exception of President Ronald Reagan.
Well, and he talked about bringing the manufacturing jobs back to the United States. And what the results of his efforts were is that President Trump's pro-growth policies were responsible for manufacturers creating 399% more jobs during the first 26 months of his presidency than Obama did in the last 26 months of his presidency. 399% more jobs.
One of the problems that President Trump has right now is that people have a very short memory. A lot of people in this country are ignorant and they're disengaged. And there is a fair segment of our society in the United States of America that does not like Donald Trump, that suffers from Trump derangement syndrome, and they want to easily push aside and conveniently forget all the job growth and the wage increases that we were having during the first 3 years of the Trump administration until we got hit with this horrible COVID pandemic.
Well, and some of the other things that President Trump did for our country, you know, he was willing to challenge China. And everything that he did in the challenging of China was the right move. The tariffs were the right move. I've always said that, as you know, I've always been a believer that he was taking the right direction and that was proving out. And China was absolutely kind of taking it in the shorts there. They lost some of their wealth, and then COVID hit. Well, what happened when COVID hit is everybody had to run back to China for what? For PPE, because they were the people that made it. They had to run back to China pharmaceuticals because they are the people that make it. President Trump is the only one of these two candidates who can bring these things home, and he's already started that process. He's already had people like Ford Motor Company making ventilators. He's already had so many different companies. I mean, even the guy that owns the MyPillow place making masks. So many places brought this home so that we don't need to go overseas. We still need to go overseas far too much, and we need to really, really work on the pharmaceuticals. There's not one iota of belief in my body that Joe Biden will do that. Why? Because he is, in my opinion, a pawn of China.
Well, you know what's interesting? You bring this part up about former Vice President Joe Biden. He was recently doing a town hall. You know, he came out of his hidey hole, and he's doing a very scripted town hall where they're throwing him slow balls. And he was asked, okay, well, what would you do better than President Trump in dealing with our pandemic, with COVID-19? And he mentioned six things. Guess what? All six things are things that President Trump and his administration have already been doing about COVID. So what's your game plan, Biden?
Well,
what are you going to do?
Sure. Nobody has a better answer. Even all the medical professionals don't agree. So Joe Biden would never in a million years have a better answer. And it could be that President Trump's answer isn't right either. I don't know. But what I know is that the entire world is affected by this, not just the United States. And it's not by his inaction that we're in the positions that we're in. It's just a nasty fact of life with COVID. But the other thing, you know, rather than go on an apology tour as Obama and Biden did when Obama became president, an American apology tour, what he did is he went to work to reduce regulations. So for every regulation that they put in effect, they effectively took away 2.7 regulations. And then he went after energy independence, and he opened up ANWR, and he opened up some other places, and he made us, for the first time since the 1950s, an energy independent country, and he runs the country like a company, which is why he's successful.
And you know what? Look what he did just the other day. Just the other day, he signed an executive order to keep our liquefied natural gas, our companies that manufacture liquefied natural gas, continuing to sell that liquefied natural gas all over the world, but primarily to Europe, because our competitor is the Soviet Union, until 2050. So, I mean, ensuring those jobs in that segment of the energy community.
Well, and another thing that he did and he believes and he followed through on is that he supports our military, and he gave them a raise to the highest wages in their history. Obama and Biden reduced our military. They took away so much from them, so much budget. We were failing as a military. We were going downhill as a military. And President Trump sees that the value of the military is to keep America safe, and it helps keep peace in the world. When we are strong, there is more peace in the world.
That's exactly right. And one of the things that we use our military for is safety projection for other countries, safety projection for the United States, and as a force projection instrument in times of conflict. So, you know, a great example is when under the Biden and Obama administration, what they did was they, in a sense, were defunding the military and defunding our Navy and defunding our Air Force and our Marine Corps and our Army, but especially the Navy, where we fell far behind on our shipbuilding. Basically, it came to a standstill.
Well, these are the things that are important to America and important to our long-term, actually our longevity in America and the world, because we are such a force in the world that if we crumble, so will go the world. That's just a matter of fact. And if you travel around the world, if you travel to Europe, if you travel to other countries, the people that live there will tell you the same. They want America to be strong. Our enemies, of course, don't. China has the intent of being number one. They're second to us right now in the world economy, and they have the intent of being number one.
And also they're second to us and coming up very rapidly in the rearview mirror with respect to their military. Okay, Russia's number three. Now, I'm far more concerned about the Chinese communist government than I am about the Russians.
Well, and it's very possible that, you know, down the road, the two may get together to come against us.
Well, they share a common communist ideology.
Sure. We need to remain strong. Those are really forgotten reasons why we need to vote for President Trump. Don't care if people like him, don't care if they don't like his tweets or whatever, but these are important things for America. And we need to get over the petty, small things that we're discussing, and the distractions, the Black Lives Matter distractions, the protest distractions, sure, the Antifa distractions, the Hillary Clinton distractions, you know, all of these things we need to put aside and think about our future as a country. And it is not Joe Biden. Joe Biden has no track record in the entire history of his political career, which is
47 years
of doing the right things, of doing anything much except for, you know, really putting money in his pocket and his family's pocket. But I will never forget, Ron, the apology tour that he and Obama went on when they were elected. And I will never forget it, and I will never forgive it. And to have somebody standing up for America that doesn't need this job, that does fine on his own, he doesn't need it. He's doing it for the American people and for our future.
Well, you know, you and I travel all around this world, and especially in Europe, and it's just amazing, although understandable given the political climate, why the mainstream media does not report accurately from Europe. Because when you and I travel in Europe, and I mean, we've taken a number of trips through a number of countries in Europe, and the Europeans that we've run into from all socioeconomic strata, and even fellow travelers from different countries, not only people we meet in country, but people we're on our various travel venues, whether it's a cruise ship or on an airline or in a terminal or whatever, or going out to dinner and running into people from other countries. It is so strong that they respect the United States of America. And as you said, they firmly believe that wherever the United States of America goes in that direction, so goes Europe.
And oh,
so
absolutely. Goes,
and so our lives, our livelihood are intertwined because we have a global economy.
Yes. Yes. And so the things that we need out of the next 4 years of President Trump is we need more manufacturing in the United States, and we need to pull our pharmaceuticals back to the United States, and we need to pull some of the other things that China is making. They're making parts for our airplanes and parts for our cars.
Oh, and all of our computers and our cell phones, all of that stuff.
And we need to pull that back to America because that is what is going to give us strength. A working country is strong.
And, you know, it's not only that, but, you know, obviously there's going to be some things that is going to be very hard for the United States to acquire. For instance, in technology, silicon, to make silicon chips, which is the, you know, the basis of all of our electronic technology. But we need, if we can't produce that, then we have to work with other countries and our allies that do produce these critical materials. Just like with pharmaceuticals, the United States cannot produce all the material, right? All of the chemicals that, you know, form our pharmaceuticals. But we certainly can do better outreach with countries that are friendly to the United States to get them to produce those things for us. And then let's increase our trade with Europe. Let's do that. Let's increase our trade, things that we're able to produce for Europe, things that the Europeans can produce in China's place for us, albeit it won't be as cost effective. But by doing that, I think we maintain America's independence and we make all of our friendly nations so much stronger.
Well, we do. And the thing that we also need to do, and I know that President Trump sees this, I've never heard a word from Biden about it, is we need to diversify those options so that pharmaceuticals are not made by one country as they are by China, who handles all of our diabetes medicines and insulins. They should be made by a number of different places so that we are never beholden just to one place. President Trump has been an unwavering advocate of America all around the world. He understands that with strength, we have independence. And I think that there's more work to be done. And some of the things that he is working on, and it's so sad that the COVID interfered in all of these things, but it did. So one thing that he is working on, which we are going to be seeing very soon, is an entirely new medical plan. So I am hopeful that it's not the Obamacare type plan, not something that's kind of Medicare for all. I'm hoping that we can keep our world-class health system in this country. And there, again, it's not something that Joe Biden is going to do for us. He's going to go back to Obamacare and double down on that.
Well, you know, I would, you know, just in my simple way of looking at things, I do believe that there are people in the United States that are extremely impoverished, that and a great example, or impoverished senior citizens that need to have medical care for themselves, right? I strongly believe that. And that should be, you know, tax financed, but for a small segment of our population. And I believe that the rest of the population could very well afford a new type of medical plan that would give us the protections that we need and that would be affordable for everybody.
Well, and he has already done that again, which Biden and Obama did not do, and that is make many, many fixes to our Veterans Administration hospitals and their health care and allowed them to go outside the system and receive health care. He also gave us the right to try so that when we have a terminal disease, we can go ahead and try to get some sort of experimental treatment that is not authorized by our FDA and go ahead and try.
You know, and one of the things to me that is huge is I do not want to pay for illegal aliens to have universal medical coverage. I'm sorry.
Oh,
I don't
no.
want that.
No.
Okay. I don't want them to have anything for free whatsoever.
No.
Nothing for free.
I agree. And it's the same when we go to any other country. We do not get health care for free.
Oh, that's right. We pay for everything.
Sure. As we should.
Oh, and I don't disagree with that at all. I just don't understand where the resonance is for, you know, people to think that illegal aliens should get free medical care at the expense of senior citizens, of the really needy, and also our veterans. Hey, listen, it is absolutely sweltering this evening. How about I get us both some iced cold tea?
You got it.
It's your news and entertainment network. News blogs, informative podcasts, entertaining videos, or listen to 24/7 talk radio on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. We the People, AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Hey, thanks for the tea. It hit the spot. Well, I'm going to give a history lesson today, and I want to talk about the federal debt. Do you have any idea how much our federal debt is?
Is it something like $23 trillion or is it more than that?
It's a little more, $26 trillion.
Wow.
Our third president, Thomas Jefferson, said, "I place economy among the first and most important of virtues and public debt as the greatest of dangers to be feared." So here we are today with $26 trillion of debt. How did we get here?
I think I know how we got here.
When Thomas Jefferson assumed office in 1801, our national debt, which resulted at that time from the Revolutionary War and a young Navy, was $83,038,000.
Hey, that's gas money for Bill Gates.
Yeah,
okay?
I know.
That's gas money in 1 year for Bill Gates.
Well, you know, true to his philosophy, when he left office, the national debt was down to $57 million, okay? So he is one of the few people that ever lowered the national debt. And those people understood that runaway national debt would drain revenue from future generations, which is what we're all concerned about, right?
Well, and don't forget, historically, we had just come out of the American Revolution. And so we were a fledgling country with already debt, remember? And so if that country was to survive, because don't forget, even though we won the Revolutionary War, which created our independence against Great Britain, they were still breathing down their necks, okay? And we could not afford to have Great Britain come in on top of our collapse. Don't forget, just a few years later, at the War of 1812, the Brits did come back to try to, you know, take over the United States of America.
Well, our founding fathers, in their wisdom, they felt that intergenerational debt, so the debt that we leave to our kids, is a disincentive for them to pay it, because nobody wants to pay somebody else's debt, right? So over the years, it just has kept growing. Our second president, John Adams, said there's two ways to enslave a nation. One is by the sword and the other by debt. What do you think we've done here? I mean, that's exactly what we've done. If you allow a government to decline paying all its debts and you overthrow all public morality, you unhinge all the principles that preserve the limits of free constitutions. You hobble the future. That was John Adams. So our founders probably would be rolling over in their graves right now to see $26 trillion of debt. And what does this mean for our future in America? How do we escape this? Well, there are some ways out. It's like you said, there's no mystery of how we got here.
And it's very painful to get out of it. But we have to work towards that. And of course, something like COVID, where we're spending trillions of dollars to, you know, bolster up our economy and our people, we are just like on the road to perdition here.
Well, yeah. And so during the first half of the 20th century, you know, kind of our folks and grandfolks era, they had a reluctance to assume debt. So they were much more responsible with their debt.
Well, because they came from the area of the Depression, they were extremely poor, and they did not ever want to be poor again because they were saddled with the national debt. And I think that's a very, very important lesson to learn, and one that's completely lost in our entitlement generation.
Well, it is. And what we're talking about, you're not going to hear in school. So then two times of outright irresponsible behavior occurred. And one was President Lyndon Johnson's creation of the entitlement state in the 1960s. He had, if you recall, the Great Society.
I was just going to say, wasn't that the Great Society? And I think at that point, we dumped something like $3 trillion in those years into the, you know, what they say, you know, call community infrastructure, education, building up, you know, low-income communities, getting, you know, kids to go to college, you know, things like that, besides government subsistence programs and things.
Exactly.
Over $3 trillion to do that. And my question is, where the heck has that gotten us?
Well, it got us nowhere, because his vision was one that got rid of poverty by imposing dependence and concentrating power. Well, he did impose dependence and he did concentrate power, but he did not get rid of poverty. And what he saw was that if you make people dependent, then they will vote for you. This is the Democratic Party.
And that is what I refer to, and you'll get pushback from this, but this is what I refer to is the enslavement of poor people. Okay, so, you know, you don't have the white master slave owner. What you've got is government coming in and taking that spot. And they, in fact, become the new slaveholders because they make the people dependent on, you know, on them, you know,
exactly.
and entitlements.
And they have political gain from distributing benefits, right?
Correct.
Well, Benjamin Franklin, back in his day, he was very perceptive, and he said, when people find that they can vote themselves money, that will herald the end of the republic. We see this all over the country now.
We saw this in California, which was one of the major reasons why we left the state of California.
Exactly.
Do you remember we had, you know, of course we had several wake-up calls, but the one that I remember the most, to me, that was the straw that broke the camel's back, and that is they did a poll and 51% of the public in California were on some level of government entitlement, government subsistence, as opposed to 49% of the people that were paying for all those entitlements. And just like you just said, in quoting Benjamin Franklin, I said to us at the time, we've got to get out of here because there are more people able to vote for entitlements than there are people like us who are paying for entitlements. This is a very slippery slope, and we are going to lose here. We need to get out.
Well, absolutely. And again, way back in history, names that people today probably never heard of, Alexander Tyler. He said, democracy can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote themselves largesse from the public treasury. And from that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidates promising the most benefits. This is what I was talking about earlier, Ron, is when you have President Trump trying to get Americans to stand on their own, to be strong, to be creative, to use all of our abilities, and then you have Joe Biden wanting to give you freebies from all the people who do work. I mean, we can't do this to our country.
And the end result has to be significant increases in our taxes, okay, in our personal income taxes, in our federal income taxes, if we're talking about, you know, Biden, if he gets elected president. He's already said there are going to be significant tax increases on a state and local level. Just take a look at California, and I was just reading today where there is a new assembly bill, of course, put forth by a Democratic legislator, Santiago.
Because that's all they have there.
Well, it is. They've got the supermajority in the California legislature. But so legislature Assemblyman Santiago has put forth tax bill AB 1253. And what it's going to do if it's passed, and it looks like it probably will pass because of the supermajority, and certainly Governor Newsom is going to sign it, is that it's taking the 13.3 state tax rate on the wealthy, all right, and those are people making between $1 and $5 million. And
well, actually, no, that rate goes way lower.
Well,
than
no,
that.
But I'm just saying they start at the top because it's how they sell it to the public, Linda, is it's the redistribution of wealth. It's the tax the wealthy, and so they start out because that's what they want to do. Hey, it's like a magician. Look at the right hand while the left hand is holding the prize, and so this bill, if passed, will retroactively, back to January of 2020, will increase the tax rate up to 16.8%. So you're going from 13.3 to 16.8, and then for sure it's going to trickle down. That's just one example from one state that underscores exactly what you're talking about.
Well, and I mean, not to get off the subject, because I really want to continue with the history, but what happens from that point is things start going up in price. So those people that are making money that may own property that people rent, their rents are going to go up. I mean, you name it, it's going to go up, because these people can't just put the money out with not getting it back somewhere. So this is a never-ending cycle. And one of the things that our forefathers saw is that it's much harder to turn that tap off once you turn it on.
Well, I definitely agree. And, you know, one of the problems that we have with these significant increases in taxes is there will not be a commensurate increase in wages. So well, people are constantly going to, don't you believe that people
absolutely.
Will constantly be poor?
Absolutely. So back to Lyndon Johnson, when Lyndon Johnson kind of really started this nightmare with the Great Society, that his spending went up from a small amount, which went from $311 billion in 1964 to nearly $1 trillion.
Oh my God.
Okay. And then Ronald Reagan took office. And Ronald Reagan actually also had a big debt when he was there. So he went from $1 trillion to $2.6 trillion. And, you know, he had cut taxes and he had ended the Soviet Union's, the Cold War. And then when George Bush came into office, it went up to $6 trillion. And then the second Bush.
Well, you remember, and one of the reasons why the first George Bush lost the presidency is
read my lips.
I will not increase taxes.
Yep.
And just like you said, as soon as he got into office, what do you think he did?
Well, he increased taxes and he got voted out of office because people want their entitlements, but they don't want to have to pay things. Well, then we have the younger Bush who expanded entitlements, and he was a Republican. He managed 9/11 and he had wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and that drove the debt to $10 million. So after that, then $10 trillion. After that, his successor, Barack Obama, just doubled it. So he went to $19.6 trillion.
You know, Barack Obama.
And, you know, I don't even know where that money went.
Well, I'm going to tell you something about Barack Obama. And you remember, since you're giving the history lesson, that Barack Obama, during his administration of 8 years, increased the national debt more than all of the presidents of the United States, and there were 44 of them at that time, combined.
Yes.
Okay, all
yes,
of them combined.
Yes, he did. Yes. And honestly, we were still in a slump, and all those shovel-ready jobs were nowhere to be found. And everything that he said didn't come to fruition, except for the lining of their pockets and Joe Biden's pockets and the Obama's pockets.
Well, at the same time, we had, I think, over 26 million Americans on food stamps, which was an unheard of amount of people on that type of government subsistence at that time.
And which is much less today, although COVID has again changed some things.
We're climbing back up again.
Well, then President Trump came into office and he cut the corporate taxes from 35% to 20%, right? And he doubled the standard deductions and he repealed the Obamacare tax. And he remade the federal tax code. So what we've got there is the economy grew under President Trump, grew and grew and grew. And that money started to repay some of this national debt. Well, and here we are with COVID, which has been a huge hit on our economy and will be for a while. But how do we now get out of this? And what the experts say, and I agree, you won't hear any Democrats say this, but if you look throughout history, it's absolutely correct, is that you have to spur the economy again. And we've been able to keep interest rates way down. We've been able to keep people buying homes. And we've got to spur the economy again. And then when the economy is good, the national debt starts getting paid down.
Well, let me ask you this question, all right? And economics is not my suit like it is your suit. But are you referring to, when you say stimulating the economy, Lynn, are you talking about another stimulus package?
Oh, No.
That's debt.
No. I'm talking about as we reopen the country, he does things to stimulate jobs again, like he did when he very first started. He has to stimulate jobs. He has to get the stock market strong. He has to get people spending money again, because we've all been kind of holed up in our houses for quite some time. And so that is how we decrease the national debt. You know, President Trump only increased the national debt in his office time $2.5 trillion, as opposed to the 19.6 that Obama has.
Yeah, you know, I totally agree. You know, I don't think anybody should be fooling themselves here. This COVID thing is so monstrous with respect to how it has hit our economy at just about every level that I can think of. It's not going to matter who steps into office. This is a huge challenge, and I would much rather have a businessman at the helm like President Trump, who's already demonstrated his acumen, you know, his experience, his success in the business community, meaning the United States business community, and getting people back to work and stimulating the economy, than a guy like Sleepy Joe Biden that hangs in his hidey hole and in 47 years did absolutely nothing to stimulate the economy. And in fact, contrary to that, put us in the damn hole. Okay, so I'll take Trump over Biden, you know, 7 days a week and twice on Sunday.
Yeah, well, we need to restart our economy and restore jobs and confidence. And that translates to debt repayment, which has been proven. Supply side economics has been proven by Reagan and Trump both. It works, and it's a matter of fact that nobody can really argue with. If people would like to see our national debt, they can go to usdebtclock.org at any time and watch it tick away.
Oh, that's a scary. It doesn't tick away. Okay, it's like brrr. That's how quickly those numbers turn around. I get dizzy and my eyes get crossed when I watch that clock.
Well, let's talk about just for a second. Let's quantify this federal debt that we have. So for every person living in the United States, it's $79,562 that they would owe. It is $204,000 and change for every household in the U.S. There is...
I feel like we're paying that now, Lynn.
Yeah. It's 121.8% of annual U.S. economic output, 7.2 times the annual federal revenues, which is very scary. And 61% more than the combined consumer debt of every household in the United States. It's not all bad news, but what is the bad news is that we cannot enslave our future generations by adding to this burden. We need to stimulate the economy. We need to get jobs going back. And that is how the debt gets paid down.
And I don't think any of that is going to happen until we get some sort of remedy, some sort of drug that can combat this horrible COVID pandemic. How about another cup of tea?
Hi, I'm Dr. Ron Martinelli, forensic criminologist, death investigator, and host of A Thread of Evidence on America Out Loud. Are you a fan of CSI shows and documentaries? Are you fascinated with how death investigators like me solve high-profile death cases like you see on the news? If so, then I encourage you to join me as I unpack some of the most high-profile police and civilian-involved death cases in my best-selling book, The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police. Read all about the forensic evidence you never heard on the evening news. You can get a copy of my best-selling book, The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police, today by ordering it on my forensic site at www.dronmartinelli.com. DrRonMartinelli.com. And remember, without truth, there is no justice. Here's your last glass of iced tea.
Well, that's all I can take anyway. So, you know, just in our conversation about voting for President Trump, here's one more reason that I've thought of that has really been on my mind and bothers me, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. But the three people that, as of you and I speaking, are still in the running for vice president is Susan Rice, And what is her history? Her history is one of trying to deceive America about Benghazi, lying to all of our face when she knew that she was doing so, and defending a lie. Then you have Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris slept her way to the top in California, and she was a very much disliked district attorney.
Well, and then she became a very much disliked attorney general.
Yes.
Okay, so why was she disliked? Law enforcement hated her.
Soft on crime.
And as a matter of fact, I remember working up in the San Francisco Bay Area when she was getting her start, and she was involved with the San Francisco District Attorney's Office and everything like that. She was hated by law enforcement up there. She was so darn liberal. She just did not fit into that law enforcement community whatsoever.
Well, and the third person on the list, although I don't think that she's going to be one of the two finalists, is Karen Bass. She has described a Communist Party USA official as her mentor. Think about these three women that we've just mentioned, all extremely progressive, all extremely socialistic.
Well, they're all anti-law enforcement.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I know I have a singular focus here, but my God, if you can't protect the people that protect the rule of law, then and you're looking all over the United States and you see the lawlessness and you see what our Attorney General William Barr is trying to do, and you see what President Trump is trying to do to quell that violence, to bring in someone in such a critical position as the vice president, I don't mean to be trite, but literally, and people need to think about this, a heartbeat away from the presidency. Then you take a look at Joe Biden. Does that guy look like the most healthiest guy you know?
No, nor is he mentally healthy, and he could be deemed incompetent. So all three of these women, thinking of them as president of this United States would destroy our country. I just can't even imagine that there could possibly be a choice when you walk into that voting booth. I can't imagine. But as I see by the polls, people are making a different choice. We will see what happens on Election Day.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I just heard today that the Republican Party has been signing up more people than the Democrats so far.
Oh, very good. Well, I mean, I know for sure I'm voting. So, you know, I can't imagine all of those protesters running around the country that are, I don't know, they look like they're drugged out, most of them. I can't imagine them heading to the voting booth. I worry much more, Ron, about the falsifying of the mail-in voter ballots.
Well, you know, let's spend a minute and just talk about that, because that's a real concern. And of course, that's really taking a lot of air out of the room in the media right now. And of course, President Trump has been opining on that. Many leaders in government throughout the United States on both sides of the aisle, Republicans, Democrats, have been opining on that. Certainly the media has been trumpeting the mail-in ballot. But I've got to tell you, as a person, and you and I, we vote the same way, meaning we're either going into the polls personally or we're doing absentee ballots, all right? The absentee ballot, people have to remember, again, that the absentee ballot system is totally different than this proposed, mail-in ballot.
Right.
Okay, because everybody that gets an absentee ballot has been vetted. We have to demonstrate who we are. We have to show identification. We have to prove our residency, where our residence physically lies. And then that absentee ballot comes to us and we always vote early. And the reason that you and I have done an absentee ballot is because we've traveled so much. Now, since we've moved out to Texas, we have been personally going to the polls, and we use voter ID in Texas, which I think is critical in a vetted voting, an election system.
Absolutely.
But I am totally against the mail-in ballots.
Yes, I am too. And some of the states like Nevada, which President Trump has filed a lawsuit against, are sending those ballots to people who have not been on the voting rolls for over 6 years. How fair is that to the rest of us? Anybody can get those ballots and vote with them, and this is how they want to win the election. Hillary Clinton came out and said that the Republicans are going to try to fix the election with the voter ballots, and that nothing could be further from the truth. It is the Democrats who are working tirelessly to have these ballots so that they can actually pump up all their numbers.
Well, you know, we've talked about this a couple of times before. Here's a great example with Judicial Watch, which is a wonderful organization that you and I belong to and we donate money to. They through the subpoena process and pressure on the Democratic Party in the state of California in Los Angeles County, were able to determine, and that Los Angeles County is a predominantly Democrat district, voting district, and they found what, Linda? 1.5 million fraudulent ballots.
Yeah,
1.5 million.
And now they've filed suits in other counties and other states and Pennsylvania and different places for the same thing, that they have to clean up their voter rolls. There is a law that says that they have to do this, and they don't do it for that specific purpose, because then when they mail out those absentee ballots or they mail out ballots, then anybody can fill them out. And that's exactly what happens.
Hey, Linda, you know, we've talked often about education and the state of education in the United States of America.
Absolutely.
So I want to talk with you about this news article about Illinois State Representative LaShawn Ford, who is presenting a plan in Evanston, which is a suburb outside of Chicago, to hold history classes in abeyance. In other words, stop teaching history until history can be revised and represented. What do you think about that?
Right, because he seems to think, from what I understand, that it doesn't represent enough of the contributions of women and minorities. And, you know, if they want to add things to the books that are true, that I'm fine with that. But you cannot revise history. History happened the way it happened.
That's why they call it history, by the way.
That's right.
They don't call it math. Okay.
There's nothing that can be done to change the history and the facts of history. So my concern has been all along, as you know, that they are revising history to make it be politically correct, to make it be the impression that they want people to have.
The inclusivity.
Rather than the reality.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that's the kind of thing that needs to stop, because who is going to control how the history is presented? Who are the historians that are going to present this revisionist history? And have they been vetted? And has the history that they represent as being a true and accurate portrayal of the American experience, right, is really true? Okay, so, you know, like I say, there is their truth and then there is the truth.
Well, you know, I recall history very well because we studied it every single day when I was in school. And I did not find that what he's saying is true. I found that women were very well represented. If there were women that had contributions, there they were. If there were minorities that had contributions, there they were. There was definitely Black contributors. There was definitely Indian contributors. There was all kinds of people that contributed to history. And back in my day, it was told as it was.
And as you remember, before I was in law enforcement, I was a U.S. history teacher. And that's the way I used to teach history. And as a matter of fact, before I started teaching history, I remember the summer, the first year I was beginning my studies, or, you know, teaching in front of an actual class, I went all over the United States to these places that I knew I was going to be teaching about. So I went to the Civil War, the Revolutionary War areas. I went all over the place. I was out in California at the time, so I got to go through all the gold rush stuff. And, you know, I went out into the Badlands and studied, you know, Custer and the Indians and all of that stuff. And it was very important for me to present an accurate accurate portrayal of the American experience during that time. And the history books that we got to choose to teach history, we pored over those books to make sure that it was an accurate portrayal. That's not the case anymore.
No, it's not the case. And to stop history entirely and leave the students that are in that time where they stop it, those people will have a hole in their education that they can't repair. And that's just patently unfair.
No, I absolutely agree. Hey, listen, I want to change the topic because I want to get back into, as you know, every once in a while, I want to talk about civilian gun violence. And I want to talk and compare and contrast that to officer-involved shootings. And because we are seeing all of these protests against what? Alleged police brutality, police shooting a disproportionate number of people of color, let's defund the police, let's dissolve the police. We've got Black Lives Matter, Marxist inspired. We've got Antifa, which in my opinion is the neo-Nazi and fascist movement, and all of these placating politicians. And then we've got the ignorant supporters both giving verbal support and giving financial support, including corporations now that are funding groups like Black Lives Matter against the police.
I just don't think, Ron, that people understand at all what Black Lives Matter truly is. And I am so insulted by these companies like Target, like Lowe's, that are supporting and donating money to them because of I don't know what, because of some...
I think they're woke, okay? That's the term. I think they're woke. And I think that, to me, it's a marketing scheme to get people to resonate with their brand. But they don't understand what they're doing and how dangerous that is. So I wanted to just...
Let me just say, these companies are donating money to an organization that wants to take those companies and America down. How foolish is that?
Okay, so you went off into left field, and I'm going to go in that direction again. But then I want to come back to my comparing and contrasting officer-involved shootings with civilian-involved shootings. But to follow what you're saying, and so we're getting people like Amazon, like Jeff Bezos, who took my book, The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War of Police, off the shelf because now he's verbally and financially supporting the BLM movement. And then you've got Starbucks and you've got, you know, Bank of America, for God's sakes, is donating a huge amount of money to Black Lives Matter. And what do you think the Black Lives Matter protesters are doing to those businesses? They are looting them and they're burning them to the ground.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I mean, seriously, I mean, how woke do you need to be to figure out that this is a Marxist-inspired movement and also Antifa, for God's sakes? But anyway, so I absolutely agree with what you're saying. They need to keep politics out of the boardroom and, corporate boardroom, as far as I'm concerned. But I just wanted to hit you up with a few things that probably a lot of people that follow Dr. Ron and Linda on Talking While Married, they don't even know. So right now, as of this week, as of this particular time, there have been 417 gun violence homicides in the city of Chicago alone. I just want to talk about Chicago, all right? And there have been 2,360 people shot in the city of Chicago, all right? That, and by the way, yeah, 2,350 people shot, but 417 killed
okay,
out of that group, if you follow me.
Yes.
All right. So the police, and by the way, these are citizens shooting citizens, of which 95% of those people that are shot are people of color. Okay, 75% are black and 17 point something percent are Hispanic, and the rest are white and Asians. Compare and contrast that with the police in Chicago so far this year have shot a total of 8 people, they've killed 5, and they've wounded 3.
Okay.
Okay? So citizens shooting other citizens of color have shot 32 times the amount of people that the police have, okay? Just in this short period of time. Now, here's what I want to tell you. Compare and contrast Chicago. All right. I mean, so here's my thing. Who are the violent people? Are they the police or are they the citizens that are out of control? But in 2019, Linda, in the entire United States, we had, and we have 600,000 officers working the field. Okay. Approximately 600,000. And every single month, those 600,000 peace officers, state and federal, you know, municipal, state and federal, make tens of millions of contacts per month. In the entire year of 2019, they killed 1,014 people. The city of Chicago, since January, they've killed 417 people, or roughly 40%. That's one town, Linda, one city. 40% of the numbers that police, that of 600,000 police officers have killed in the entire United States. Does that give you, can you wrap your arms around that? Does it give you a little idea of who the violent people are in the United States?
Well, the context is just that the entire narrative is a lie. And it's a lie put out by the media. It's a lie put out by Black Lives Matter. It's a lie to do exactly what they are doing, to defund the police, to cause chaos, to just everything that is happening out there, Ron, is exactly what they planned for, and people are falling right into it. And who is mostly falling into it? Although a lot of middle-aged people are falling into it, really it's those young people that have been indoctrinated in our schools that are believing that America and the police must be bad.
You know, and you're exactly right. And I just want to leave our listeners with a couple of ideas here. And that is, we got ourselves into this predicament. And by the way, Linda, I've got a brand new article that talks about all these statistics and everything coming up on America Out Loud. So I hope people will go into America Out Loud. I'm not a frequent writer like Linda Martinelli is for America Out Loud, but I'm pretty sure that you'll see Dr. Ron's article coming up where I compare and contrast officer-involved shootings to civilian shootings. Please read that and share that with your friends.
Well, Dr. Ron, I'll give myself a plug on the front page of America Out Loud as we are speaking. And in the next couple of days, it will move down the list, and it will permanently be there, is the article that I just wrote called Bring Back the John Kennedy Democrats, Lose Progressive Socialist Democrats. These Democrats today are not the Democrats that they were in the John Kennedy era. They are not, you know, we used to have two parties that pretty much got along. We had more of a friendly rivalry, and now we have a very, very divisive.
Oh, we're definitely at war.
Hateful.
We're at war.
Rivalry. So that's my article. I like it. I think it's worth a read. And it is on America Out Loud.
And you know what? One final plug. I hope people will take time to read my best-selling book. And we're in our seventh printing, The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police. And they can get that on my personal website, drronmartinelli.com. drronmartinelli.com.
And hey, while you're at America Out Loud, catch all the great authors on there and you know, the great podcasts and the great live shows. I mean, there just is so much talent in this organization. You just become addicted to it.
And that's what we want people to do. How about it?
I'm ready.
Me too.